Hello and welcome to the Leap of Faith. Seagulls, the sounds of traffic and people chatting about you. It's the clue. We're in Trinity College. To my right-hand side here, the cricket grounds, and behind me, the library where the Book of Kells is on display. Over 1 million people a year come and visit the book. Though, if you haven't had a chance to visit it, you can certainly find out more about it. Now there's an online course that'll give you an even deeper insight into it. And with me here is the director of the Loyal Institute, Dr. Fancha Ryan. Fancha, why is this book so popular? We need to set it in context for people who know it's there, but maybe necessarily might know its importance.
The Book of Kells, yeah, is one of the star attractions, I believe, along with the Guinness stores, that it's one of the two key star attractions for tourists to Ireland and for Irish people also to see it. It's a wonderful treasure. It's one of the most richly illuminated manuscripts that we have in Europe, dating from around 800. The amount of illustration on it is massive. It's a book of the four Gospels, largely, and then a little bit more information as well, like canon tables and things like that at the very beginning of it. We don't have all the folios left, but we've got most of the Book of Kells still with us in Trinity College Library, where you can see it, where it's on display. And people come to see it and to just admire the beauty of it. I think also there's a display there when you come into the Trinity College Long Library, and you can learn more about the Book of Kells from the display that's available to you. It will teach you a lot about the Irish culture and society at that time. It was a culture which was a mixture of pagans and then the Christians, the new Christians, who were seeking how to pass on their faith to others. We know it was produced by what we call monks, but I think we need to remember that those monks were very different from, we'll say, the Benedictines or other types of monks that we would have had developing on mainland Europe at that time. The Irish way of Christian life was different. It was related to Rome, in contact with Rome, but it had its own distinctiveness. And I think that's another thing that comes out in the Book of Kells, because even the work on the Book of Kells, the artistry on the Book of Kells, is different from a lot of the other manuscripts that are to be found on the continent from this time.
Do you remember the first time you saw it?
I remember the first time I saw it here when I came to work in Trinity, but I also remember telling my mother that I was teaching this module on the Book of Kells, and she said, oh yes, we used to bring you to see that when we were living in Dublin, and you used to love seeing the little animals, the cats and the mice. And I used to see the cats and the mice, but now I know what the cats and the mice stand for, what's going on in the page, which is called the Cairo page, where you see the cats and the mice, you see an otter and a fish, and you see moths. So it's been something, I think, that's been within the Irish culture that my parents were bringing me to see it from the beginning.
Now, it's an interesting one. If you look back, like, where would it have been commissioned by, or how would it have been paid for, as something that I'm presuming is an extremely intrinsic, expensive piece of work, even at the time?
It was. I mean, we can't answer any of these questions definitively. We even argue over where the Book of Kells was produced. It was more than likely drawn, written on the island of Iona by monks belonging to the Columba family of monks. So there were, in that time, we can't speak of Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales, but we're talking of Ireland was, or these islands, the insular islands. We would have a similar culture in Ireland as we had in Scotland and in the north of England. So the monks produced it there. The number of calves that were required to produce it were huge, so that brings back who provided these. I would imagine it was being done over a long period of time, and because the island of Iona is quite small, so they wouldn't have been able to have enough calves there to produce enough vellum to produce the book. So we imagine it was produced over a long period of time, produced out of love, and I suppose the kings would have wanted it to be produced. Who exactly? And the monks also would have been interested, because they had a story to tell and to communicate. It was produced as a manual labour, but also as a work of love, because these were people who had dedicated their lives to God in a particular way, and who were educated, they knew Irish, that was their home language, and then they were also educated in Latin, and it seems to us they also knew some Hebrew. So they were producing these books from their love of God and their desire to pass on this knowledge to those who were not able to be in the monastery.
For you as an academic, you can look at the book and, as you say, its beauty. What about the theology that's under it? Is there anything that causes conflict?
I suppose the very fact that we would be saying that there is a theology in the Book of Kells could cause conflict with other academics, because people look at it from their different fields, their different specialities. Within the theology of the Book of Kells, there are different pages that are given different interpretations, and that is quite fascinating. in the past, I think they would have looked, some scholarship, the early scholarship, and early, I mean by 20, 30 years ago, was looking at the pictures and saying, OK, what does this picture seem like from my knowledge of the Gospels? But today we're looking as well to see, OK, where in the folios does this come? Where in the Gospel passage is this coming? And therefore we might say, this folio, which is, some people say, a folio of the arrest scene, well, maybe it's not the arrest scene. It's Jesus on the Mount of Olives praying. So now some scholars are calling it the Orans page, the page of Jesus praying. And that fits into the text that was going along. For me, I am fascinated by the learnedness of the scholars. They knew so much, not only of the Bible, of the New Testament, but they also knew the ancient Greek tradition. They had access to the philosophical insights. They had access to stories which come from a long time ago, and they brought them into their reading and production of this manuscript.
The book itself is only yards away from where we are at the moment, and when people go in to visit, they get a glimpse, they get a chance to have a look at the book. But now there's an opportunity to see it in greater detail.
Yeah, there are two opportunities, and both I would highly recommend. They've both been wonderful to me in my teaching. One is you can actually access the Book of Kells digitally. You can go online and look at a page and look at the details on the page. But more recently, with a colleague, Dr. Rachel Moss, we've developed what we call a MOOC, a massive open online course. It's available free. The second run of the course began just a week ago. And anyone, anywhere in the world who has access to the internet can access this course. It's a four-week course. Once you sign up, you get free access for 6 weeks to the various lectures, inputs, videos, which bring you more detail on the Book of Kells. My part, my main input was on, obviously, the theology of the Book of Kells, but you'll also get a chance to learn about the production of the Book of Kells, the conservation of the Book of Kells, the art in the Book of Kells, because we've different colleagues here who have collaborated in the production of this MOOC, and it actually has proven to be a very, very popular MOOC. Students have joined from over 130 countries. We've had, I think, about 20,000 students now thus far between the two runs. A lot of the students are from the States, but they're from all over the world. It's a very popular course. And I think the Book of Kells itself, being so beautiful, lends itself wonderfully to an online digital access course. They get the opportunity also to try and do the calligraphy themselves. We have someone teaching them how to do a little bit of calligraphy. And then you get the comments as people realise how difficult it actually is for someone from our age, this computer era, to go and do something in calligraphy.
Well, now, there's no delete key, backspace or tipex when they were putting the Book of Kells together. So what happens if there's an error in a page?
Okay, from my perspective, it's surprising the few errors that there are there when I look at my own work. But there are errors there, obviously. Sometimes they will cross out the errors or they make comments. There's places where there's things repeated. So they have little marks to show that they've made an error here. So there are errors. They're marked in some cases. And in other cases, I mean, I suppose what surprised me most is the lack of errors. Because if they made a mistake, they weren't going to throw away the page like I might do today if I was writing a letter to someone. Because vellum was expensive, it was valuable. So they'll mark it with little X's. They'll try and scrape it out as well. You get little examples of where they've tried to scrape away the mistake they've made. But I just go back to repeat again. They didn't make that many mistakes. They worked more carefully than we perhaps do today. Time was different to them. They had all the time in the world to produce this book, this labour of love. They had given their lives to living in the monastery, different type of monastery. They'd given their lives to God. And again, I think another interesting thing is they were probably the younger people who were doing this. And scholars would say this because, of course, they were working with poor light. They had to have a very steady hand. So it was younger people. And, of course, people didn't live as long as they do today as well. I mean, there's arguments over the number of scholars that were involved in it, the different, what they call the different hands that were involved in it. Were there four hands? Were there two hands? Had we someone doing the illustrations and someone doing the writing? Or all that is the subject of ongoing scholarly debate and discussion. Fascinating.
And is it possible one of the scholars may have even written himself into the book with a red beard?
Well, now, that's an interesting point because I suppose the Book of Kells is produced on these islands amongst what we call the Celtic people. And they see it very much as their book. They don't see Jesus Christ as a man who was born in Bethlehem and has nothing to do with them. Jesus Christ and the story has everything to do with them. And they go so far as to produce Jesus Christ as a red-headed Irishman. And they say that if you look at the images of Jesus throughout the Gospel, you'll find that at the beginning he's clean-shaven and then he'll get a beard because he ages as the Gospel story goes on. It's quite fascinating. And that's what leads me to say that it wasn't just monks doing a job they were asked to do by the boss, but it was a labour of love and they were thinking, meditating, thinking theologically, prayerfully, it's all the one, as they produced the book.
So, with everybody enthusiastic at this point, how do people sign up?
Well, you could simply Google, I suppose, the Book of Kells MOOC, but perhaps an easier way would be to get onto the Loyola Institute webpage, and on our news items we have a direct link into the online MOOC on the Book of Kells. And you can see the other activities we're doing at the Loyola Institute as well.
Dr. Foinsha Ryan, Director of the Loyola Institute at Trinity College, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Sometimes life ain't easy, filled with all the ups and downs. Oh, Lord, make it easy. Surround me with your love. Whomsoever you show mercy, on that blessed day, his face will be beaming. Oh, Allah, for this I pray. So believe me, Allah, when I say, La ilaha illallah. There's not another like you, Muhammad.
There is only one God, sung by Omar Simon, as we leave behind the warm spring sunshine at Trinity College and join this talented singer-songwriter here in our Donnybrook studio. Omar grew up in the Caribbean, moving to the UK at the age of 13 before finally settling in Ireland. His latest track, Trust in Allah, which is being launched today, is dedicated to the people of New Zealand following the Christchurch terror attack 2 weeks ago. Omar, we'll talk about your new track and this poignant tribute that you're making in a few moments' time. But first of all, let's hear more about you. And there's a lot to talk about, including your Christian upbringing, your conversion to Islam over 23 years ago, as well as your music and your unusual insight into Irish culture. What's the Irish connection for you?
Basically, I'm from Montserrat. My background, my mom was born in Montserrat. It's sometimes they call it the other Emerald Isles.
I've heard this, yeah. In the Caribbean.
In the Caribbean. Yeah. And it's the only island, as far as I know, which celebrates St. Patrick's Day.
What is the Irish connection for the island? I mean, it goes back, I think, to almost indentured slavery, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. That's right. I think a lot of... the Irish were shipped over there by the British, yeah. You know, and they, you know, a lot of them remained there and intermarried with the locals.
So there's lots of Sweeneys and Murphys,
yes,
and various and other families.
Ryan
and Ryan, yeah, exactly.
Now, we actually have towns there called Kinsale and Corktown, and, yeah. You know, so it's very interesting.
Now, you were there as a young boy. We'll find that story in a minute, yeah. But you were back recently, and that was quite an interesting experience for you.
That was last year. I went back actually with my mom. Part of the island, the southern part of the island, that is, that's more or less covered in volcanic ash. And it's really a no-go area at the moment because the volcano is still active.
You know? And a lot of people have left or emigrated now from Montserrat.
Yes, a lot of people went to America, Canada, and now Ireland and UK.
Yeah. And that was the story for your own family, because even though, as you say, you were born in the UK, you found yourself being sent over to family, I presume, as a young boy.
Yes. When I was 2 years of age, born in London, when I was two, my mom took me over to live with my grandmother. And
Not unusual for families from the Caribbean.
No. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, like, back then, life wasn't, you know, born with a silver spoon. So my mom and dad had to work very hard. My mom was a dressmaker. My dad worked for London Transport. And, you know, they would send money over, you know, to keep me in school and things like that. But it was a great life. I mean, from, you know, 11 years in Montserrat, I just remember the fun part.
But also at that age, there would have been a fair amount of influence on your faith. Who influenced your faith for you at that young age?
Well, you know, in the Caribbean, people are normally very religious. And, you know, it's a small community as well, because the island's very, very small. 13,000 people.
Everybody knows everybody's business.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used to go with my grandmother to Methodist Pentecostal church, and you know, it was great then because, you know, you had all the musical spirit and, you know, in the church.
And so. Music.
Yes, oh, absolutely. Yeah. The Pentecostal is known for that.
And in that period of time when you were there, were you did you find yourself just adopting whatever messages were sent to you, or had you developed a questioning side to you at that stage yet?
I think I was very young then.
Yeah.
It wasn't until really later when I came back to UK, and it was actually not traumatic experience coming back at 13 years of age, but it's like you're open then, you know, everything was very, if you like, rules and regulations, school uniforms, school dinners, and things like that. And I think it was then, I started to look at life a little bit more like, you know, well, what's there?
What's it all about?
Yeah, what's it all about?
And then you had a chance in meeting with a man from Pakistan.
Yeah. Yeah,
what happened there?
Yeah, that was much later in my adult life. I really never ever thought about Islam, even growing up as a youth, and I never was exposed really to Muslims. Mm. But this particular person, I always remember him. His name was Raza, and he spoke to me about Islam and. We as Muslim, he says, believe in the Virgin Mary and the miraculous birth of Jesus. May God's peace and blessing be upon him. I was surprised at things like that, you know.
Did you feel you were being evangelized? Did you feel that you were being recruited at that particular
time? Hardly at all, no. Yeah. I felt that, you know, he just had an information which he wanted to share, and I was sort of receptacle, if you like, to the message, and I wanted myself to know more, so I asked him to get me can you get me an English translation of the Quran, and he got me one, and I just like couldn't stop reading it.
What was it filling? Was there a void? Was there an emptiness that it was filling, or did it displace anything?
No. This is one thing that a lot of people, you know, say, like, you know, religion, you must have, if you embrace a faith, you must have been something they're missing. Mm. No, I had a great life growing up, loved by my parents, loved by my family, and I didn't really, you know, never any delving in, you know, in alcohol or drugs or nothing like that, you know, just clean living.
It wasn't about being saved.
It was just, as I said, it was just something where I was taken aback that Islam was actually so close to what I was brought up with, which it was Christianity. And I myself wanted to know more, and I just kept reading about it, and I thought, you know, this is for me.
When was the day that you stood up and said, I'm Muslim?
I was 33 years of age. And, you know, I was only reading the Quran for about 6 months. But as I said, like, I was reading no other book. I was, like, just completely engrossed. And I think I decided then that was for me. Because I found then that it was a way of life, a way of... What can you say?
Heard many people say this before, that, you know, that the directions that we're looking for, guidelines, principles of what you need for life were contained therein. But I'm sure you're also aware that there are people who can take those same guidelines and turn them to whatever their objective is. Because we know that while there's a very much a peaceful message, there's also a message that sometimes frightens people.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I mean, everyone is... like, not just Muslims, Muslims, but I mean, like, you know, there's...
Well, indeed, any faith can turn something to its own course,
exactly.
Its own purpose. Yeah.
For me, basically reading the Quran now over so many years, some of the things which is perpetrated so much by some Muslims, I should say by a minority of Muslims, because vast the amount of Muslims, we're nearly 2 billion people, and it's a small minority, which unfortunately, this is the case, do make, you know, a bad name for many others.
Tell me about the Derry girl.
Yeah, the Derry girl, yeah, that would be my wife, yeah. I hope she's listening. Oh, she's not listening.
Well, go on, you're going to tell me.
Well, we met in UK, in London. I was a manager in a big amusement complex, and she was a cashier, and we met, and yeah, the rest is history. Five kids later,
she converted to Islam too.
Yes, she did.
You moved to Ireland.
Yeah, she converted about 6 months after I did. Secretly, I didn't even know she was reading my books, she was reading the Quran and other books, and I was surprised one day. She says she wanted to be Muslim too, which is fantastic, great.
Mm. And your children?
My children, I mean, we try to, bring them up according to, what we believe in and what we, they're big kids now. My youngest daughter, she's 16 years of age, and, they're quite welcome, if you like.
And now you work with colleagues in your place of work. Do they ever express a curiosity about you, your faith, the fact that you pray five times a day, or that you may, look for time off work so that you can go to the mosque?
Well, yeah, I mean, to be fair, the people in work, my supervisor and such, this was one of the first things that I said to her. I said, listen, I don't mind working. I'd start at 6 in the morning, I don't mind. But just on Fridays, I'd like to go to the mosque to pray, And, she was very accommodating. And, sometimes, obviously, I can't go. So, therefore, I have a little room that I go in and pray. And sometimes some of the staff, they will come in and they find me praying. And there's a lot of respect there. They know that it's only going to take like 3-4 minutes. Mm. So they'll go out again. And then when I'm finished, they'll come in. So,
Omar, in parallel to this is the role of music. And I want to explore it a little bit further, because you would have been very much involved in the music scene, particularly in the UK, I think, as a singer. We heard you singing at the start of the interview as well. Does that fit in with your faith now? Can you have an interest in secular world of music?
First of all, thank you very much for asking that question, Michael. It's a very, very, very interesting question. It's not easy. It's not easy because a lot of people, Muslim people, see music. I mean, again, this is not just about Muslims. Even there's certain Christians themselves that see music as sort of like, it's like the other side, the devil's music, if you like. But myself growing up, before I became Muslim, I grew up on music. So I saw the beauty of music. And so when I became Muslim, I found people saying, no, you're not allowed. You're not allowed to do music.
No love songs, unless it's to your wife.
That's right. I still sing to her. So, so I didn't have a problem with music, and I never saw Islam reading through all the reading that I've been doing. So, I mean, I must have read the Quran about 20, 30 times by now over the years, and I haven't found anything in the Quran which prohibits music. And, I see music almost like it's part of nature. You're surrounded by, even when the birds sing, that's music. Music is something as well which I see, which the way I look at it can bring us closer to God, if you like, from a spiritual sense. But I mean, what if the music encourages love and harmony, peace and so forth, then there is a consensus among many Muslims, I wouldn't say all still, which would say, yes, there's no harm in it. And certainly over the last 10 years, a lot of Muslims have come round to accept that music is, a beautiful way of expressing.
But I'm getting a sense that if you didn't have music, you'd burst.
Yes. You've got it. Yeah, that's it. Huh? Yeah. I mean,
Omar, we can't leave this conversation tonight without asking you your reaction to the terror attacks on two mosques in Christchurch 2 weeks ago. You actually went on Friday night to the mosque, and you said that there was a particular atmosphere.
Yes, Michael. I went on the Friday. It was actually, we call it Juma, the Friday prayer, which is around about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I found there was many Irish at the back of the mosque, you know, standing and basically paying their respects to what had happened. So that was very nice to see that, you know, a whole community coming together to show their sadness and condolences for what had happened.
Do you feel fearful as a result of the faith that you now hold?
You know, well, it really goes back again, you know, like this song, Trust in Allah. And that's basically my motto. I trust in God Almighty, you know. And I'm more fearful for other people than so much for myself, you know, especially for, you know, young Muslim women who wear the headscarf. And, you know, my own daughter, you know, she told me one day that she, you know, she was called all kind of names on the Lewis train by two individuals, you know. So it's really, for myself, is to try and lend support to my own family and also to others at large. But for myself, no, I don't feel fear.
Well, let's finish with more of your music. I know you want to dedicate this new song, launched today, Trust in Allah, to the people of New Zealand. Tell us more about that.
Yes. Again, you know, I feel I have no choice in this matter. You know, it's something which has touched me and has touched a lot of people around the world. This is a case of, you know, showing support and love for, you know, those who have passed away and for those who have been left behind to be the scar.
Omar Simon, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith this evening.
Thank you very much.
And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. Till next week, from producer Sheila O'Callaghan and from me, Michael Cumin, good night.
Welcome to Days Like This.
Days like this, we gotta trust in Allah and we gotta be all. We're gonna be alright.